This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, May 13th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton. We'll speak with Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Tamora Israel of the Provincetown Banner and Jason Graziadei of N Magazine and Nantucket Current. And we'll speak with CAI's Eve Zukoff and Patrick Flannery. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station was heating up the news cycle this week with a number of new developments. It's been 3 years this month since the plant stopped generating power, but the process of dismantling the plant and dealing with the nuclear waste is ongoing. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us with this story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Jeanette, last Friday, Senator Ed Markey hosted a hearing in Plymouth looking at the regulatory oversight of nuclear power plants. It was an opportunity for many in the community to speak up and to hear from the company in charge of decommissioning the Pilgrim plant. A lot of news seemed to come out of this one meeting. Tell us what happened.
Sure. Well, the biggest news coming out of that meeting really was from Chris Singh, the CEO of Holtec, which is the company that owns Pilgrim, of course. He pledged not to dump radioactive water into Cape Cod Bay unless what he called major stakeholders approve of it. And by that, he said he means officials like Senator Markey, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the state. So on the one hand, it seemed like that would be good news for concerned people in the community. But Singh also warned that not releasing the water would translate into a delay, possibly a long delay in redeveloping the property and finishing whatever extent of cleanup can be done on the property. Mary Lampert, a longtime Pilgrim activist, called that a veiled threat, essentially to slow down the process. They actually have up to 60 years legally to clean it up. So that's a long time. Additionally, beyond getting that pledge about the water discharge at this hearing, Singh agreed to allow third-party testing of the water to see exactly what's in it. And that is something that Senator Markey was asking for throughout the hearing.
There was a moment in this hearing when Singh was asked about the options, other options for disposing of this water, this million gallons of wastewater from the plant. And they've already sort of said that they could possibly truck it off site. But when he was asked what that would cost, it turns out he didn't even have a number for that. Is that right?
Right. And one of the officials at the hearing said that they were taking that as evidence that Holtec wasn't taking that option seriously.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission testified at the hearing as well, and the agency really came in for some criticism here. Tell us what people had to say there.
Yes, that's true. The NRC took a lot of criticism. And again, this is not sort of from public commenters, because this was an invitation-only kind of hearing. So we're talking about not having the people that we hear all the time criticizing the NRC, but actually people like Senator Markey and Seth Schofield from Attorney General Mara Healey's office. He said that when they reached a settlement with Holtec, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission opposed the state's efforts in that process. The state was trying to get financial assurances that Holtec would have the money for the cleanup and that they would meet Massachusetts state standards for the cleanup. Senator Markey and Congressman Bill Keating were seated up on the judge's bench for this hearing. Both of them said they feel like the NRC isn't doing enough to listen to community concerns or provide oversight of nuclear plants broadly. Markey in particular actually said that the new rules for nuclear plant decommissioning that the NRC is in the process of sort of writing and bringing out to the public now, this new set of rules they're working on, would allow plants to cut corners on safety more than they have in the past.
So all of this happened at this meeting Friday in Plymouth. And then on Monday, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission itself was in the spotlight again as the agency held its own meeting in Plymouth. And this was not exactly about Pilgrim. Explain, what was the purpose of this hearing?
Right. So that meeting Monday was hosted by the NRC itself, and that was to explain this new set of rules that I just mentioned. These are national rules that govern the decommissioning of nuclear power plants, which is when it's not just shut down, but it's also sort of dismantled and things are removed and all of that. The rule changes they're proposing are not related to the water here in Cape Cod Bay, but some of them would reduce requirements for things like emergency preparedness around the plant. If there were some sort of a spill, things like physical security and then cybersecurity at decommissioned plants. The NRC's argument for this is that as plants are putting their fuel in long-term storage and they meet other kind of milestones of the process of decommissioning, that the risk of a nuclear accident or a security problem at the plant is less over time.
There's a public comment period on these rules. People can weigh in still.
Yes. Originally, the comment period ended May 17th. It's been extended until the end of August. Comments have to be submitted online, but they do give you kind of two options for how to do that. If you have a document you've already written, you can attach it, or you can just type it directly into a text box there on the site.
I want to ask you about a development that came yesterday. You followed up to find out more about the idea that the water coming out of the plant should be tested and that Holtec appeared to agree to last Friday. What happened there as you were following up on this?
Right. So at Markey's Senate hearing, he said a number of times that the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution should serve as the third party expert testing the water at Pilgrim before any kind of decision gets made about releasing the water into the bay. he said, you know, they're local, they're experts, this is great. Well, I did check in with HUI, and while they are really interested in these issues, a senior scientist there, Ken Bissler, says HUI doesn't do land-based water testing, right? They're an ocean science organization, this isn't really their thing. So he says, Pilgrim will have to find another lab to use, but he supports the idea of testing. Another thing, yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to kind of move on. Another thing that happened this week that's related to the testing, though, is that a little more of the debate about who's going to pay for it. Chris Singh, who's the CEO of Holtec, he sent a follow-up letter to Markey saying that at the hearing, Markey had offered to sponsor testing. Markey says the money should be coming from the decommissioning trust fund. This is an account that Holtec controls. It was funded by the electricity ratepayers of Massachusetts for the purpose of safely decommissioning the plant.
The scientist that you spoke to at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Ken Bissler, he said they don't do testing of this kind of water when it's on land, but they do test it when it's in the ocean. And he had some very specific recommendations for the kinds of testing that would want to happen here.
Right. He said the testing should be done by a lab that can make highly sensitive measurements to detect small amounts of the various radioactive elements they're going to be testing for. A less specialized lab could do testing where a lot of radionuclides would come up as undetectable just because the amounts are lower than that lab normally tests for, right? So you could get a sheet of results. And for some of the radioactive elements, it'll give you a number. And then a lot of them, it will just say like ND, non-detect. And what he's saying is, you know, make sure the testing you're doing is going to be advanced enough that you're not going to get a bunch of these non-detects and then wonder how much is really there. It's just, it could be some amount there that's less than what they test for. Also, he talked a little bit about the timing. He says, wait till Holtec feels the water is treated enough to be released before you do the testing, because otherwise a company could say, well, you know, we found XYZ in the water, but we'll take care of it before we discharge the water. So Bissler says people shouldn't have to rely on their word after the testing.
Hmm. A different story in the news this week also involved Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. A prominent activist was arrested about, 4 years ago for trespassing at the plant. Her case was just now dropped. Listeners may recognize her name, Diane Turco, who's with the group Cape Downwinders. CAI Sam Houghton has this part of the Pilgrim Nuclear story this week. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Sam, first, this case is in many ways another way in which Diane Turco is bringing more attention to what she sees as deficiencies at the plant. Remind us about the details around her arrest.
Right. Yeah. Turco told me she brought two NPR reporters to the power plant, one of them actually from CAI, and walks onto the property. She says they were able to walk right up to the plant and basically see all these dry casks with radioactive material stored in them. To her, that's a major issue if, say, a terrorist were to walk on the property and try to blow up those casks. The surrounding area, of course, the Cape would be basically in peril for if that were to happen. And she brought these reporters to show how easy it was to do that. And this is in her words. Of course, she was later arrested for trespassing. So flash forward to now, the case has been pushed back and delayed. That was in 2018. It was delayed some by the pandemic, but Turco's day in court was supposed to be Monday. And her group, Cape Downwinders, had arranged a panel of experts to testify, something like 10 people, including a former state senator, Dan Wolf, some scientists. And she was supposed to face a jury, but before that could happen, the judge dismissed the case because state's only witnesses, that was a couple of police officers in Plymouth and Turco's hometown of Harwich, and a security guard at the power plant, they didn't show up. And worth noting, the state prosecutor didn't try to delay the hearing, which might happen if there's, a scheduling conflict often with a witness.
It's not every case where the state's only witnesses don't show up for trial. What was Turco's reaction? Why did she think the witnesses didn't show up?
Yeah, well, her initial reaction, she was angry. She wanted an opportunity to make her point that the security at the plant is still lacking. She thinks the state was complicit, knowing there are security issues there, and they're embarrassed and don't want to hear the case. I asked her if Holtec had gotten in touch with her or she thought that security may have improved there since, but she said that, someone making a documentary was able to walk on the grounds again and film. So she told me that if anything, it's gotten worse. Right. I guess her reaction, anger, disappointment, she couldn't make her case. Another interesting wrinkle to this Pilgrim story.
Sam, let me stay with you here and turn to another story this week. The Falmouth Select Board decided to remove its town manager, Julian Suzo, from the job. It started with a tense meeting on Monday, followed by another public meeting last night. A town manager plays a really big role overseeing town issues. What were the motivations from the board to do this?
Yeah, I think this has been brewing for some time, but really kind of the public at a meeting a few weeks ago when a negative kind of review of Suzo came out to the public. There was a lot in this review, but some of the highlights, several high uptown employees have retired or resigned recently. And the board wanted an explanation from Julian Suzo about why that might be the case. There was some concern that town employees aren't comfortable speaking freely without fear or retribution from the town manager. That may be a reason why some of these employees have left. There was also criticism that he's not addressing some of the biggest issues facing the town and the region, like affordable housing and coastal resiliency. The board also said he isn't very transparent with the public, and a lot of them said they spent a lot of time fielding complaints specifically about the town manager. And then Suzo fired back on Monday. An interesting meeting. I think the surprise, at least to me, was he kind of lashed out at a couple of board members. For one, the former chair, Megan English Braga, had applied to an open job in Town Hall, the town's legal counsel. She wasn't picked for the job, and Suzo says that caused her to be biased in her negative review of him. She was kind of taken aback with that accusation and found it insulting, at least at this public meeting, she was saying that. And she's since gotten kind of a higher job, so that accusation was really unfounded to her. There was a lot of back and forth at that meeting Monday before the board ultimately asked him to resign on Monday. And he refused. I think the quote that's been going around is, "I politely decline." And then the board last night voted to fire
him. Well, tell us about last night's vote in the meeting. What was that like?
Yeah. So the chairman, Doug Brown, basically said it's become apparent the relationship with the board and Suso is beyond repair. The board took a vote. It was unanimous. Suso made one comment that he's been contacted by his attorney, and that was it. The assistant town manager, Peter Johnson Staub, he's going to fill in as the acting town manager. Suso has issued a press release with a quote from his attorney basically saying that he's been wrongfully terminated. It was a brief meeting, really short. I thought interesting, but I don't think the story is over. Suso is in the first year of a three-year contract. He's hired an attorney, so it'll be interesting to see kind of what comes out of those proceedings. And Steve, if you'll let me, just a quick shout out to the Falmouth Enterprise, my former employer. They've had some great coverage of this story.
They have, and following it along very closely as it's happening.
Yeah.
Sam, also this week, two well-known local nonprofits working together launched a new mapping tool that they say will help the housing crisis while also protecting open space. But even before we get to that, we hear a lot about the housing crisis. You've got kind of a shocking statistic that just came out that illustrates what that means.
Yes. Yeah. 150 homes. We reported this, I think, last week. 150 homes for sale on the Cape for under $1 million. Just an interesting fact there.
Only 150 homes for sale on the Cape under $1 million. That suggests the tightness of the housing market. Tell us about this collaboration now between these two groups and this tool that they're putting together.
Yeah, I thought this was kind of neat. This is the Association to Preserve Cape Cod and the Housing Assistance Corporation on the Cape. Two groups that you don't always see eye to eye, housing and conservation, but they set out 2 years ago to kind of map all the Cape and find out where developing housing makes the best sense and what areas should be protected for environmental reasons. I spoke with the Housing Assistance Corporation director, and she said that, you know, those early discussions on how the mapping would work were challenging. As she was trying to push for more housing, essentially as the Housing Assistance Corporation. But the two groups kind of agreed on a set of facts, like parcels that were connected to a sewer line or were close to a school, public transportation or a village center, essentially. They would consider that, well-suited for housing, potentially dense housing. They had criteria for environmental issues as well, like land close to wetlands or over sensitive water resource area. And once they had that kind of groundwork, they plugged it into a GIS mapping system. And the results is this color-coded online kind of interactive map. But as we were saying, I think the validity of this system is the fact that you have two well-respected local institutions on both sides of this issue, housing, the environment, agreeing on these set of facts. Because a big complaint, when trying to develop housing recently, the old "not in my backyard" or "I'm all for housing," and these arguments tend to throw the environmental card a lot. But if you have the APC saying, well, that's not actually listed as environmentally sensitive, or maybe it is, that might move the needle, the discussion in another direction.
That is CAI Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
And CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
It's the news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we will be speaking with Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the news roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. All week, Martha's Vineyard has been focusing on our changing climate with forums and events. Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette joins us with a story that points to a very specific change ongoing in the natural world. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Steve. Good morning.
Good morning, Bill. This is a great piece you have. It looks at striped bass, our iconic species, as a kind of canary in the coal mine for climate change along our coast. Tell us a little bit about the story and how you kind of got into it here.
Well, yeah, it's the it's Climate Action Week, so there's events, as you said, happening all over the island, from dune restoration projects to oyster growing tours. Everything's going on, to eco anxiety talks with psychiatrists. Every base is covered. So we wanted to commission another piece, and we talked to Paul Schneider, and he's actually our editor of the Martha's Vineyard magazine here for many years, and he focused on stripers, as you said, as a canary in the coal mine. One, it's a very popular fish around here, but two, it really, the species travels up the whole Atlantic coast, and it just is really a perfect example of the effects of climate change seen through the lens of this species.
For folks who aren't fishers, the striped bass are just such an iconic part of what summer means for many, many people along the Cape and the coast. And their arrival this time each year is something that people who fish are looking forward to all year long. But the arrival is always a little bit in doubt, and it's been changing in recent years, just like population numbers have been changing. And a lot of the factors here seem to be environmental factors. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. The story begins down in the Chesapeake, which is like the big striper nursery. And a female striper can lay up to 3 million eggs down there, which is pretty just amazing. But of course, that's a hugely fragile time for many, many reasons. But lately, climate change is having an effect too. One of the things that Paul talked to a lot of scientists and research, there's sort of two, what they call almost a double whammy going on. You've got the jet stream, so the warming air, but then there's the Gulf Stream, which is, you know, pushes warmer water up to these areas. And another interesting thing they found is it's also pushing saltier water up here through the Chesapeake and up further north, which surprised them, they said. They thought, you know, with melting ice and things like that up north, there would be an uptick of fresh water in these waters. But the salt water from the Gulf is winning. The issue then is, although striped bass are diagenous fish, meaning they live in freshwater and saltwater and are quite adaptable, it's a really tricky time for eggs. So if they hit a saltier water patch, they could die. So that's sort of one big issue that's happening with the Gulf Stream. Also, with the warmer water coming up, it's sort of shrinking the window for this big nursery time, because too warm water isn't right for hatching. So some fish, they've noticed, the scientists have studied, have started hatching earlier, almost like 3 days earlier for 1 degree rise in temperature. So you can really track exactly how a species is adapting to this new, you know, this new paradigm. But with the warming waters, even though you go earlier, there's a smaller window, so it's really affecting the hatching period. And then, of course, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that you mentioned adaptation, and the adaptation that's pointed to, that Paul Schneider points to here, one of them is that the range of the striped bass has never been fixed, and it keeps changing, and they adapt to many different climates, and they may even be adapting to spawning much further north than they ever have before.
Yeah, it's sort of fascinating. So they are starting to push north, but they also have been north in the past too. They've spawned in the rivers of Maine and up in Canada. So it the species isn't just fixed on one location. They're also the Pacific. One of the interesting things also is that it's not just climate change, right? Like the Maine rivers, which was a big spawning area for a while, humans put a lot of dams in there, and that stopped the spawning area. So there's other factors, you know, human obviously for climate change, but other human factors that have affected the spawning areas.
It's a great article with a lot of nuance to it. I encourage folks to seek it out. That's at the Vineyard Gazette. It's by Paul Schneider. That is Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette joining us. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
$102 million. That's the sale price of a property in East Harwich. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle has this story and joins us right now. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
Tim, this is a commercial property with a pretty amazing location and a lot of history, but that's still a price tag to make you blink, $102 million.
Yeah, we're told that it's the highest price paid for property, commercial or residential, in Harwich ever. And so it's a pretty big deal. And we're talking about the Wequosset Resort and Golf Club in East Harwich. It's located right on Pleasant Bay. It's got 27 acres, 120 rooms, and it's been around since 1925. It was purchased on Tuesday by a New York investment firm called EOS Investments. And they bought it from the McLennan family, which has owned it for the past 45 years. And clearly, you know, the real estate market is a seller's market right now. And it was clearly the time to sell this property if it was going to be sold. The company that bought it owns other properties on the Cape. Last November, the firm bought the Red Jacket Resorts, which included five properties on the Cape that had been previously owned by the Davenport family. You know, Steve, like you said, the Wequosset Resort is a beautiful property. It's got beaches, four restaurants, tennis courts. It's got one of the only five-star rated restaurants on the Cape. And it also provides access to the Cape Cod National Golf Course, which is right next door. Now, Mark Nevada, who is the resort's managing partner for the past 36 years, he said under the new owners, the staff is expected to stay on. And he said even he's going to stick around as a consultant for a little while. EOS now owns 17 properties in New England, you know, with 1,000 guest rooms and nearly $125 million in annual revenue. So, you know, we talked a few weeks ago about the Wayside Inn in Chatham being bought by a New York-based investment firm. So this is just another instance of an outside firm coming in to take advantage of the current real estate situation.
I kind of want to dovetail this story with another story that you have here, because all of this, the booming real estate market puts such a pressure on housing stocks. And meanwhile, you know, in the middle of this, Chatham this week, I want to underline this, they scored what seems like a significant victory in the pursuit for more affordable housing for the town. Tell us about what happened this week.
Yeah, that's definitely true. The town has been really, really trying hard to identify both town-owned and private property that could be used for affordable housing. And this week, the select board announced that they've reached a deal with the Catholic Diocese of Fall River to purchase 5.26 acres of land off Meeting House Road, that's Route 137, in South Chatham. And this land will be used strictly for affordable housing for folks who make up to 100% of the area median income. The church has owned this land since the 60s. It's across the street from Our Lady of Grace Chapel, which is a summer church that the parish here in Chatham uses. And the diocese said that the land has been unused, and they were responding to a request for proposals that the town put out earlier this year. And they reached a sale price of $525,000, which is just in line with the value of the land, according to an appraisal that the town commissioned. The fact that it's going to be 100% affordable is good news for, as you said, Steve, folks in Chatham who work here or live here and are trying to find a place to live amongst the, you know, the real estate values, where, you know, the average sale price of a home in Chatham is well north of $1 million. So the average working person in town really can't afford that. Mm. And this will provide, they say that they can fit up to 22 bedrooms on the land, you know, that would roughly be maybe 10 houses, according to current regulations. But the town is right in the process of bringing sewers down Route 137, so that could increase the density. So they'll be conducting a feasibility study to determine the shape and size of the housing that will go there in the next few months. And the deal is expected to close by August. You know, with some things coming up at town meeting tomorrow, also dealing with affordable housing, you know, the town is starting to take a real aggressive approach to finding places for young families and working people to live in town.
It's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
a Native American modernist painter and summer resident of Provincetown, has his artwork now on a series of U.S. postage stamps. Tamora Israel of the Provincetown Banner has this story. Hi, Tamora.
Good morning, Steve.
Tamora, this is the painter and sculptor George Morrison. Tell us a little bit about him and his connection to Provincetown.
Yeah, George Morrison is a famed Ojibwe artist, and he is the founding figure of Native American modernism. So in the 1960s, Morrison was active as a teacher and exhibiting art in New York and Provincetown. And while summering in Provincetown, Morrison began making these monumental collages with driftwood and found objects that were unique yet reflected of his friendship with Louise Nevelson. So Morrison was raised in Chippewa City, Minnesota, and he found his love for art when he was a child and in bed sick for a year with hip surgery. And that's where he found his love of art and painting and drawing. And he spent many summers in Provincetown building these large collages.
His artwork is kind of abstract. It has a lot of rhythm in it. There's some nice pieces shown here in the article that you put together. Tell us about these stamps now that are appearing. The U.S. postage, the U.S. postal system has put a number of his artworks onto stamps, and it's kind of a limited edition, right?
Yes, absolutely. They are flying off the shelves. They were in back order, but they're now available in Provincetown and, you know, wherever stamps are sold. So there are five different stamps. The first row is Sun and River, created in 1949. It's watercolor and crayon on paper. The second is Phenomena against the Crimson Lake Superior Landscape, created in 1985, and that's acrylic on canvas. Lake Superior Landscape, created in 1981, is acrylic on canvas again. And Spirit Path, New Day, Rock, Red Rock Variation, Lake Superior Landscape, created in 1990, acrylic and pastel on paper. And the last is Untitled, and that was created in 1995, and that's color pencil on paper. And a lot of his artworks have a horizon line, which are kind of like his calling card, and marks the boundary between known and unknown and the mystery that Morrison repeatedly explored as he continued to refine his modernism vision.
Now, you went down to the post office in Provincetown to find out what kind of response there's been locally to these stamps from an artist so connected to the town. What did you find out?
Well, I found out that the stamps were flying off the shelves and they were in back order when I spoke to acting postmaster Wendy Palmera. And when I was there, she had to order them again and tried, but they were in back order. So when that happens, the post office connects to other local post offices. The closest one would be Truro, to see if they had any, and they didn't. But since Monday, the stamps have been available, and they can be picked up.
That is Tamora Israel joining us from the Provincetown Banner with a neat story about local artists whose artwork is now appearing on postage stamps. Tamora, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. The unresolved 2018 hate crime on Nantucket, in which the historic African Meeting House was vandalized, is once more in the news. Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current joins us with this story and more. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
Jason, the plaintiffs in a civil rights lawsuit that comes out of the incident are looking for a court judgment. This is not a criminal prosecution. Explain a little bit what's happening here.
Correct. So several Nantucket residents have brought this civil rights lawsuit in Nantucket Superior Court. As you mentioned, no one has been charged criminally with this crime, which happened over 4 years ago on the island. So it's really been this sort of unresolved, sort of festering issue. And this civil rights case has played out over the last couple years. And, you know, over the last year, they did name a person that they believe perpetrated this crime, an island resident named Dylan Ponce. And most recently, the plaintiffs in the case have asked the judge to for a summary judgment, finding that he is in violation of the Massachusetts Civil Rights Act. And what happened recently in the most recent filing is that Ponce's attorney said he would not be opposing this motion. So now this goes to a judge unopposed, and we will see what the judge does going forward here. But it was notable that this motion was not opposed and that the defendant, who was deposed in this case, continues to invoke his Fifth Amendment rights and has not answered any questions that were put to him under deposition. So again, island residents, over 4 years have been looking for resolution in this case. Very painful for a lot of people on this island. And so we've been covering this, and this was the latest machinations of the civil rights court case in Nantucket Superior Court.
And in the end, these island residents, the two that are kind of pushing this along, are saying that nothing has happened on the criminal side of this. And so this seems to be the only recourse to continuing to pursue this case.
Correct. I mean, they continue to be upset and hurt that both local and state officials have not gone to the bottom of this and charged someone with what happened, 4 years ago on York Street at this, as you said, historic building on the island. So this is a way for them to pursue justice in this case and try to get answers for what happened and hold someone accountable. And it continues to play out, and we'll see where this goes. If the motion were to be approved by a judge, these plaintiffs, Jane Barros and Rosemarie Samuels, would have obtain a civil rights injunction, and an immediate stay away order would go into effect on the person that's been accused in this case. They're asking for a stay away order and that they keep their distance from them personally, as well as the African Meeting House. Mm.
There's a lot there, and people can go to your website, Nantucket Current, and get some of the background as well and some of the ins and outs of the legal efforts around this. I want to ask you about another story, too, this week. Nantucket held an election. One of the big winners, affordable housing?
Absolutely. So we had 13 ballot questions that were put to voters during Tuesday's election, and voters were in a very giving mood. They approved almost $58 million in temporary tax increases, known as debt exclusion overrides, for a variety of projects. Nearly $20 million of that will go to affordable housing projects on the island. The town has put significant resources over the last 3 to 4 years towards affordable housing. Those projects are in various stages of development and planning. And these votes on Tuesday will allocate money for construction. Land has been acquired with previous funding measures, and a lot of this now will go to construction and new home ownership initiatives on the island. And as you guys know, on the Cape, on the islands here, this is probably the number one issue that we face as a community is the affordable housing crisis. So voters were very willing to put those resources towards this issue at both at town meeting and at the polls on Tuesday.
It's Jason Graziadei speaking to us from Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks.
Thanks for having me on.
Pro-choice activists will rally across the region tomorrow to protest the Supreme Court's leaked opinion to overturn Roe v. Wade. CAI's Eve Zukoff has details on the planned rally. She joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hey there, Steve.
Eve, where are these protests going to be happening, and what are they likely to look like?
Yeah, so bans off our body events, that's what they're called, are planned for a bunch of places all over the region. They're planned for the Falmouth Town Green, Hyannis Airport Rotary, Five Corners, and Tisbury over on the island. There are also going to be protests in Wareham, Orleans, and at least 9 other Massachusetts communities. And I think that there's going to be a lot of opportunities for people to kind of hold signs, chant. Again, the ones on the Rotary, I imagine they will be looking for honks in support, but they're all organized by kind of different groups. So they might each look a little bit different than the others.
And this is in conjunction with a nationwide effort, right? These rallies are going to be happening across the country.
That's right. Hundreds of rallies, if not more. It's my kind of loose estimate, but I counted 9 in Massachusetts alone. So there will be, it's part of a national day of action. That's right.
And to be clear here, it doesn't appear that women in this state, in Massachusetts, are in danger of losing access to abortion if Roe versus Wade is overturned. Is that right?
That's correct. In Massachusetts, the state law protects the right to abortion, but the Supreme Court is expected to make its official decision on abortion rights and whether or not they'll overturn the 50-year ruling in Roe v. Wade in June. Once that happens, 26 states could move to ban abortion in at least some form. Some states will do so outright, most likely.
And so as you've been looking at the rallies that are planned for tomorrow, what's the expectation there? What are you expecting to happen?
Yeah, well, I'm expecting people to bring signs, chanting, maybe some speeches. I think the thing that I don't yet know is, will there be counter protests? We have put some calls out to local police departments to ask about managing potential conflicts between pro-choice and pro-life groups. And we haven't heard back, but I will be on site most likely tomorrow, at least one of these rallies. So I'll have more reporting on this next week.
Eve, let's turn to another story. Let's talk about North Atlantic right whales, the critically endangered visitors who spend winter and spring in our local waters. This week, researchers released a paper that links the declining size of female right whales to fewer calves. What can you tell us about the paper and what it tells us?
Right. So this new paper from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, New England Aquarium, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, says there are smaller whales now, smaller females producing smaller offspring per reproductive year. And this is a problem because, just to be clear here, this research builds on a paper that came out last year that showed right whales are shrinking. One whale born today would be expected to be about a meter shorter than a whale born in 1980. So currently, full-grown members of the species average around 13 to 14 meters in length. And the problem is energy reserves. These whales are smaller because they have less fat. They appear to need longer recovery time from the energetic cost of giving birth. And it's a big problem.
So why do scientists think that right whales are now shorter?
They think it has to do a lot with stress and impacts of entanglements, ship strikes. That's when they get hit by boats. That all of those two things are mainly are two good indicators of stress that are driving this change. So, we know that ship strikes can be fatal and entanglements can lead to infections, starvation, drowning. But even when those events don't kill whales, they can cause long-term harm, researchers found. So when the mammals get caught in, human detritus and end up dragging it around, it forces them to expend more energy fighting to survive instead of growing or repopulating their dwindling species. One researcher told me, imagine if you had a sandbag tied to you and tried to go about your daily business, you'd be burning just a lot of extra energy dragging that sandbag around.
It's relevant then that we are right now at the end of calving season for these whales and the season where we see them appearing in our waters with their new calves. Give us an update there. How did calving season seem to look?
Well, look, the birth rate of the population, which now numbers less than 350 animals, is already at a 40-year low. This season, I think I have this number right, scientists are aware of 15 mother calf pairs. That's worse than last year when there were 20 calves seen, but it's a lot better than the year before that when it was just 10 calves. I mean, it's all relative, but no matter how you slice it, these numbers are too low to sustain, let alone grow a population where the death rate is higher than the birth rate year after year.
Mm. Eve, I have about a minute here. I want to ask you about a story that's coming up next week. You have a special climate summit that is happening on the Cape. Can you just give us a little sense of what is going to be happening here?
Yes, it's a summit for 14-year-olds, basically, 14 through 18-year-olds. There are 6 schools, I believe, at the moment, committed to sending students to a youth climate action summit organized by Mass Autobahn. And I got the schedule just this morning. They're going to be going to breakout sessions, learning about eating for the planet and your health, the economy of climate change, interpreting climate science on Cape Cod, preserving open spaces for climate preparedness. I've been told they also are going to do some kind of mock town meeting, because, you know, even as adults, it can be intimidating to go to your first town meeting and figure out what the heck is happening here. Why are they using all of these words, and what is the process? And students expressed at last year's summit that they wanted to know how to get involved with their towns, and they didn't really know how to wade in. So this year I'll be watching them do that and learn, and we'll have some reporting out of that as well.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
The town of Brewster is getting a new public beach, but they're still figuring out what to call it. CAI's Patrick Flannery has been covering the story for us. He joins us now. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Steve.
Patrick, the Brewster Select Board was lined up to make a decision this week on a name for the beach. They had held a contest. They narrowed the choices, but it hasn't happened yet. Tell us what happened on Monday when the Select Board met.
Yeah, more than 500 residents of Brewster submitted name suggestions for what to call the shoreline off Main Street that now belongs to the town. And Monday was the day the Select Board expected to discuss a short list of those name ideas, and the plan was for members to vote on that name. But the town administrator, Peter Lombardi, told the board that the town first wanted to hear from leadership at the Wampanoag tribe. And the reason being, a number of potential names for the beach acknowledged the town's Wampanoag heritage. But the town wants the tribe's leaders to clarify whether those suggested names are culturally sensitive and historically accurate. So the plan right now is to vote on the name in a couple of weeks. It was postponed until May 23rd, when the Select Board will revisit this and then vote at that time on the new name.
Now, it's almost never that a town on the Cape gets a new public beach. Remind us what's going on here. This beach is part of a purchase that Brewster made just in the past year.
Yeah, the beach is a 55-acre piece of land that for almost a century belonged to the Cape Cod Sea Camps. And as we know, the Sea Camps were a beloved institution. People were sad to see it go during COVID. But when the opportunity came for the town to buy that land last year, Brewster voters said yes to paying $26 million. And of course, that included the shoreline we're talking about, a brand new beach on the Cape. So things seem to be moving along now. The expectation from the town is that the beach should be open to residents in time for July 4th weekend, if all goes well.
And to enter this contest to name this new beach, you needed to be a town resident, right? A resident of Brewster. Any ideas what the entries were like? Any leaks? Did you hear anything about with these 500 entries? What kind of things have been floated?
Boy, did
for this?
I try. residents only. And I've tried a number of times to get that short list on those names, but they want to wait until they get the tribal sort of perspective on those suggestions. You know, people on Facebook said, how about Tidal Flats or Peacock's Landing? But I like the Camptons. That's my vote.
That's very good, the Camptons. And the winner here, the person who gets their name selected, what do they get?
Yeah, they get a pair of free beach parking stickers, right? Which are what? Those are $45 a piece these days. So not a bad prize for the first prize winner.
That is CAI's Patrick Flannery speaking with us. Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton. We spoke with Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Tamora Israel of the Provincetown Banner and Jason Graziadei of N Magazine and Nantucket Current, CAI's Eve Zukoff, and of course CAI's Patrick Flannery there. A big thank you to Elsa Partan for engineering the program today. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.